The Pat Kenny Show on News Talk
with Matter Private Network. During current restrictions, don't ignore your health concerns. Our expert team is ready to help.
And it's Anton Savage in for Pat. The final installment in a trilogy of books surrounding the issue of Irish political prisoners has just been released. Here to speak with me about it is the author Sean McConville, Professor of Law and Public Policy at Queen Mary University in London. Morning, Sean.
Good morning. How are you today?
I'm very good. I have to say this is a remarkable piece of work. I mean, it is both heavily researched, heavily footnoted, detailed, and it is but one of the three that make up the trilogy. How long did you dedicate to this, the total task?
I started working, I hate to say this because it makes me sound like a complete crank, but I started work around the autumn of 1994. And this last book was published in the spring of this year.
It really is remarkable because the phrase gets bandied around a lot, the definitive history of, but rarely can you point to something so clearly and say that's the definitive history of. It really is.
Yeah, well, that's very kind of you to say so. I mean, it was a lot of hard work and, well, as you say, it's lasted a long, long time.
The last of the trilogy, the thesis on which it is based is also very interesting because in essence, and it is hard to distill something of this scale down to its essence, but in essence you attribute far more impact to the actions taken by Republican prisoners in Northern Ireland to the ultimate result of the Good Friday Agreement than all of the work done by the politicians.
I wouldn't put it quite that way. Could I put it slightly different way? I think you're on the right track. But what I would say is that unless the prisoners had agreed, it would have been very difficult for that peace treaty to have been signed. The prisoners really had a veto on it, both Republican and Loyalists. I mean, if they just said, this is a sellout, we're not going to do it, we've spent all this time in prison, it would have been almost impossible for the respective politicians to deliver.
But you outlined the impact that the prisoners themselves had, both politically and on public opinion. And one of the things that I was fascinated by was you attribute as much, if not more, impact to the dirty protests as you do to the hunger strikes.
Yeah, no, I think that the dirty protest was a far more important action. And it really fueled the hunger strike. The dirty protest, I mean, I've been studying prisons all my professional career, is the most remarkable protest that I have read about and studied anywhere at any time in the history of imprisonment as I know it. It was an astonishing, I mean, for 40 months, people lived essentially in their own filth, and not just by themselves, but with a cellmate. And if you think about 40 months and think about those conditions with maggots and the stench and the smell, and every two or three weeks being taken out and hosed down and put in a fresh cell, which you then started to do this again. I mean, it wasn't just excrement and urine that they used, but it was bits of rotten food, everything. And to keep that up for 4 years, I think it was an astonishing thing and created a core of people. I mean, if you commit yourself to that, and many of them left it, by the way, but if you commit yourself to that and you stick through it, and you stick through it with other people, you create a camaraderie and, in a way, a kind of sense of authority. You know, this is me. Look at what I've done to show the strength of my feelings. And that, I think, had an enormous impact on the politics of the whole matter.
And in the same context, you talk about the move from, I think the phrasing is, from breaking out to breaking up, about how the desire to get publicity for rebellion rather than freedom from escape was so significant.
Yeah, no, I got puzzled towards the end of this. I mean, puzzled throughout at various things that have arisen. But one thing that began to puzzle me was why bother to escape when you knew that your organization was in an advanced stage of peace negotiations, which would inevitably be followed by some kind of amnesty. So why bother to escape? And there are two or three escapes. The most notable one was Whitemore escape. Whitemore was out in the Fens in Cambridgeshire, And it was an astonishing escape. If we had a little bit of time, I could go into it. But essentially, what it involved was a group of people living very close proximity to their guards, who managed to conceal. And by close proximity, think a student shared flat. I mean, very, very few people there, being supervised by guards 24 hours a day, and yet they managed to conceal one of the most elaborate escapes from one of the most difficult places to escape from in these islands, and carried off the escape. Now, no arrangements were made for transport to get them away from the area. That's the relevance of the remote fens. So what was the point of it all? And the point was for the organization to say, look, it is true that we're in negotiations, but we've still got some bite left, and our members have still got some metal and can show what they're made of. That was my conclusion. It is the only explanation for that escape and for some others.
On the topic of escapes, we have to discuss Maidstone.
Yes. Maidstone was the internment ship, an old depot ship that was used. And again, a remarkable escape. So almost looked as though it had been scripted by Hollywood, actually. Great study of the movement of the staff and everything else. And then over the side, in a murky Belfast evening, into icy cold waters of the lock, swimming across the lock to a dockside, commandeering, their transport had gone. They'd had to delay the timing of the escape. Their transport and the people who had to meet them had gone. Commandeering a bus and busting out of the docks area. And of course, within 10 minutes or so, in safe houses in nationalist areas of Belfast. But it was a remarkable escape. It was remarkable that none of them were drowned.
And of course, it was compounded by the escape from Northern Ireland, because the forces in the north were still searching for them several days after they were happily squirreled away south of the border.
Yeah, at the moment we've got we've got climate protesters blocking the M25, the ring road around London. Well, you think that kind of traffic jam in Belfast? Some people were stuck for several hours as the troops went through the cars one by one by one. And then these guys were produced in Dublin for a press conference a few days later. I mean, that was remarkable in itself, that they just eluded all attempts to track them down. That was a truly remarkable escape. And that was very, very early days, so it's 1971, when there was a rash of escapes.
Yes, and you argue in the book that to some extent it was indicative of the shift in public mood, that the level of availability of safe houses, support, that the closing of ranks of the community around the escapees showed the way internment was reacted to.
Yeah, I think internment was an enormous political blunder on the part of Brian Faulkner. And what it did, and he kind of acknowledged that in his memoir, what it did was to inflame Catholic opinion in the North, nationalist opinion in the North. And whereas in previous episodes, the border campaign, which ended dwindled away at the end of the 50s, it really wasn't supported by very many people and consisted of things like blowing up power pylons and all that kind of thing. By 1971, internment had enraged the Catholic population.
And on that topic, the other thing that was enraging to the Catholic population that is to some extent, I suspect, forgotten, is the brutality of the interrogation techniques, which you lay out in some detail.
Yeah. No, it shouldn't be forgotten. And of course, it's still pretty fresh, because the very same techniques were used in Iraq and elsewhere. I came to the conclusion, and I use the words deliberately. I mean, I looked at the law and all the experiences that people related to me. I think the term deep interrogation, or interrogation in depth, which was used, was a complete euphemism for torture. This was highly organized torture. It didn't involve the breaking of the skin or the breaking of bones, but it was torture nevertheless. And one of the people that I interviewed, a man I came greatly to respect, actually, Paddy Joe McLean, now sadly died, put in a stress position. I forget whether it was for 34 or 43 hours, but something like that. A responsible man, a special needs teacher, a man, incidentally, who had denounced violence before he was picked up and publicly denounced it, he said to me, after some hours of what they'd done to me, I thought they would have to kill me, because if I got out, I was going to tell people about it. And sure enough, he did get out, and the case became public. His case of another 13 men, became public. And the case went to the European Commission and then the European Court of Human Rights. And the British government were brought there by the Irish government and were found guilty of inhuman and degrading treatment. I think they were guilty of torture.
Well, it is but one of a series of fascinating instances detailed in the book. The book is called, 1960 through 2000, Braiding Rage and Sorrow. It's available from Routledge Publishers, and the author is Professor Sean McAlvin. Sean, thank you very much for joining us on the programme this morning.